Pope Francis has appeared before 150,000 pilgrims massed in St. Peter's Square for his first Angelus prayer, and he asked the faithful to pray for him. If you had one prayer, I don't think you're particularly religious, are you, Penny Ashton?
Not
if you
in
had,
the slightest.
If you had one prayer you thought might be efficacious, what would it be?
Well, I don't know. I just rebel so much against my Catholic upbringing and praying, and I don't believe in praying. But I believe in positive thought, but not so that it actually achieves anything. I think it's good to be positive, but I don't believe in combining your minds to make change and things. I'm being very, very bah humbug about all of this. Just that people would get on a bit more and people would stop killing each other to the same extent and things like that.
Thank you.
World peace. I'll just wave like, I'm Miss New Zealand and I'm praying for world peace.
Well, in fact, those Miss New Zealand contestants whom you're mocking that used to talk like that always also wanted to meet the Pope.
Right. Well, actually, in the new ones, because of course I've done my beauty pageant research for my last show, they want things like gun disarmament and, you know, there's actually quite a lot of sort of a lot more modern wishes.
Well, especially in Hamilton.
Stuff. In Hamilton, yes, yeah. Especially. And in Japan, less knives.
Less fewer swords.
Yes. Yeah. What about you? What are you praying for?
Fewer Madonna songs on the radio.
When you call my name, it's
stop
like
right
a
now.
Little...
Okay.
You see, you've mentioned it and you've encouraged her.
You've ripped the
scale. I don't think she needs a lot of encouragement, mate, really.
Okay, I've got another question for you.
Right.
If you could bring a species back, because scientists, I don't want to go into the whole ins and outs of it, but this is a Harvard-based project which reckons it can resurrect the woolly mammoth. And they're also trying to resurrect a species of pigeon called the passenger pigeon. In fact, they're looking at various creatures. If there was one species you could resurrect, what would it be?
This is such a huge question.
Yeah.
What's the purpose for doing it? Is it, I mean, one obvious thing would be, what would be a really good meat source?
Yes, the moa, clearly. That was a big meat source before.
So apparently, it was a huge meat source.
Yes, exactly.
They were massive, weren't they?
And the dodo. There's been meat on the dodo.
But then that's the other thing. I mean, the dodo and the moa are a good point. I mean, the mammoth died because its time had passed. It had done its dash, and clearly it was out-evolved.
That's a harsh way of looking at it.
Well, my apologies to any mammoth fans who happen to be listening, you know. They died out naturally, as opposed to, you know, the moa and the dodo, which were definitely anthropogenic extinctions.
And hoia. And things like
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. And well-paid teachers. These are all things that have died out because of the act of man. So maybe we might want to consider bringing those back because, you know, their time had not necessarily passed.
Mm. The moa seems to be the animal of choice with our listeners. This project is trying for the woolly mammoth, and because there are some extraordinarily, as you probably know, Steve McCabe, well-preserved carcasses and Siberian permafrost.
No, that's biology. I do real science.
Scientists in Russia and South Korea have embarked on this project to create a living mammoth using the DNA-storing nucleus of a mammoth cell and an Asian elephant egg.
I was reading lots of other ones too. There was like the mastodon. I was trying to bring them, but then I thought we'd have to come up with a new metaphor for someone that's really old if you bring back the mastodon. But there was this one that's a frog that swallows its young, and then its stomach works as a uterus to raise the froggies, the froglets, and then they vomit the froglets back up again.
Oh, you're just as well informed.
Yes, I read about this in another article. I did some research on this
good
one.
For you.
And found it was like 20 animals they're thinking of bringing back. But things like the saber-toothed tiger, I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, it depends, really. Yeah. The issue is going to be, are we going to do one for novelty purposes? Look, everyone, here's a woolly mammoth, and then it dies, and then it's extinct again. Or are we going to actually try and get a breeding population going?
And then where?
Yeah, where do you keep a breeding population of woolly mammoths?
That's exactly right.
Siberia, presumably. But, I mean, seriously, if you bring back one, that's it. Novelty, and it dies, and you have to do another one. You keep doing it. Bring back two, and you have to hope that you get one of each. And then you've got a breeding pair, but then you've got an extraordinarily shallow gene pool, and you're going to get, like, inbred mammoths. Are they going to, like, think that the Napoleon or something? This is not going to be a healthy species. You're going to need to have genetic diversity.
And imagine how much that fur coat will be worth when it dies.
Oh, yeah.
And Peter will get involved.
Oh, yeah.
So this is a complex... Somebody's
not really thought it through.
Well...
Our listeners have a somewhat irreverent attitude towards this whole, but the dodo, apparently they were very tasty, says Roscoe of Waipokoto. Extinct species to bring back. Social Democrats, thank you. The extinct animal of choice, an impartial media that did not thrive on hyperbole and editorialising.
No, we can bring back anything, but you've got to be realistic here. Come on.
and Haast's eagles to keep everyone on their toes.
And obviously some things should be extinct.
Yes.
Like, as far as I'm concerned, the ACT Party and things like that.
Well, they're flooding in now, the seditions. All right, thank you for yours. Thank you for yours.
See, we had some Pope things to say, but you've glossed over that.
We did, so, yes. Yeah. That was Jim's prayer.
Yeah, that was his prayer. Yeah. We're not talking about
this is a forum of free speech.
Well, I just was amazed that Robert Mugabe is going to the popification or the crowning or the beauty pageant for popes, or pope factor, I believe I was calling it. Pope idol, you know, my Cassock rules, etc., etc.
You're going to hell, you know that,
yeah,
don't you?
Well, yeah, absolutely. But Robert Mugabe is going to that. So, I mean, I just think,
He's technically a head of state, unfortunately, so it's kind of protocol, really.
And I didn't even know he was Catholic. Obviously, thou shalt not kill isn't too much in his vernacular.
I didn't know he was going. How old is he now?
87 or something like that. I was reading about it today. He's not allowed into Europe theoretically, but because the Vatican is the city-state, he's got to go through Europe, unless he's dropped in from a helicopter.
Oh, that could be fun, yeah.
Just like, you know, the Queen in the Olympics, it'll be Robert Mugabe at the popification.
So technically he can fly into Italy and go to the Vatican.
I'm not 100% sure about that, but it's saying that he is going to it is what, but maybe this again.
Or
this
at the very least, he's been invited.
Yes, and exactly.
He's not blocked. See, I would, you know, but I'm not allowed to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, to be fair, someone like him doesn't really fit in with the new message of Pope Francis, does he?
Yeah, well, you know, he's obviously a lot more austere, etc. Obviously, I wish they'd be a bit better on gay rights, but he's a pope, so that's probably not going to happen.
Well, he's not just a pope; he's also an extraordinary. I mean, doctrinally, he's a fantastically reactionary. He's a Jesuit. What do you expect?
I don't know much about Jesuits.
God's riot police.
You can't call him fantastically reactionary when he's just spoken so much about social justice, even in the last couple of days.
Doctrinally. He is.
You mean he's conservative?
Yes. When it comes to things like dogma and theology, yes, he is. He's a Jesuit. He can't help himself. But socially, he's very much aligned with Francis of Assisi, who, to a certain extent, he named himself after.
So he's all about social justice for everybody except the homosexuals.
Well, obviously, because
it's in the Bible, blah, blah, blah.
They're hoping he can accommodate the liberal elements within...
Yeah. Well, he's more likely to than his predecessor,
certainly.
Well,
he's certainly doing some really interesting things already, for the poor. And, you know, that whole thing about wanting the church to be poor. I wonder that the real estate people going, oh, yes, we could sell this Vatican for quite a lot of money.
He's distanced himself from liberation theology in South America because, obviously, there's too much Marxism in that and the doctrine just wouldn't gel with his Jesuit
and gay
practice.
Marriage in Argentina. Big fights with the.
That's not going to happen. I mean, this is a man in a frock, obviously.
Clearly,
he's not going to allow gay marriage at all.
Well, it is, but they had a big fight about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not going to happen. But he's clearly very aligned with many of the ideas of liberation theology. He's clearly aligned with the idea of poverty, of focus on social justice, which is going to be hard not to do when you come from that kind of environment. But, I mean, that's what the church is doing in South America.
But it's also quite interesting. I think China's making a lot of money out of it because apparently one of the bigger things being sold is cathedral pins and calendars and posters with his face on them.
They're
probably coming from China.
Trinkets that are coming out of there are fantastic.
And the amount of money it costs to put on one of these conclave thingies. I am being disrespectful in a way. I just do not like the amount of money that's spent on these things. And it's something that I think is... anyway, I'm going on. But,
To be fair, I don't know they actually spend that much additional money above and beyond the day-to-day running of the Vatican, which presumably is a fairly expensive operation.
Surely they do. They have to putting up all those people.
The two people who didn't have much to say about the Pope, you've done quite well.
The prayer thing, not so much. Pope, yeah, we've got to go to town on that.
I'm sorry I introduced the topic. It's 18 to 5 o'clock.
I'm a Catholic. I'm allowed. Such a good Latch Catholic. I've decided I'm a pro-Latch Catholic.
There's no such thing as a lapsed Catholic.
Yes, there is.
Once a Catholic, I'm sorry, you're always there. No,
Penny Ashton, Steve McCabe.
I used to practice. I got so good I don't need to do it anymore.
Oh, right, I see. Right, okay.
Oh, you're lapsed as well, eh?
Yeah, afraid so.
What else is on your mind, apart from the Pope and social justice?
Yeah. What else is there, really? Well, so is social justice, in a way. Has it struck anyone else that this is a phenomenally expensive country to live in?
Yes, it struck a lot of our listeners recently, and they've been emailing about it.
Exactly. I mean, it keeps on hitting me. And it's just something that's been reinforced lately, that we've been doing a lot of home improvement projects, and we're having a new kitchen put in. And that itself is an expensive do, but we decided things like, concrete example, metal example to be exact, we thought we'd get a new cooker. And so we went down to our local favourite whiteware retailer, and we saw a cooker that we really liked, a nice big thing, and we saw the price tag, and it said $6,300. And we thought, no, we don't need a new cooker that badly. But then my wife, Debbie, who's altogether more resourceful about these things than I am, said, look on the internet. So I did. And it was a British make of cooker, so I looked in Britain. Found the identical machine in the UK for £950.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And we worked out that after buying it retail in the UK and getting it stuck on a container and shipped out to New Zealand, we could still get it for somewhere between a third and a half of the retail cost here.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I know, I do a lot of internet shopping as well.
It's currently somewhere in the English Channel.
Right.
And so why wouldn't you? Why are people still getting away with that kind of, effectively, price gouging in this country?
I mean, I can understand it when things have to come. Not to that extent. Yeah. That markup is crazy. But things like, for me, that really get me is iTunes.
Yeah.
You know, something's been
delivered. There is no physical product.
Exactly, you know.
And, but in a case like that, they talk about licensing, about taxation, and I know they're hand-waving you off.
And they talk about the size of the market, even with iTunes, for example.
But that shouldn't matter for the size of the market for something like that. I can understand for physical things, but for something that's delivered to you through the wires, I don't see how the size of the market makes any difference.
No, I think one of the problems we've ended up with here is that New Zealand has got itself a mentality that says we're this little country way down the middle of nowhere, hanging off the edge of the world in the middle of the Pacific, and we're a long way away, so it's always going to be hard to get stuff to us, so we'll just take what we get and we'll be grateful for it. You kind of got this deficit mentality going on where it says we'll be grateful for whatever we're allowed to buy. And so companies like, I won't name names here, but the company who's selling our cookery in New Zealand, they're getting away with charging this much. They are the sole distributor of that particular brand, I found out. And the wholesaler in this country is the same wholesaler as in the UK. So there's clearly just monstrous markup, because people go into the shops in New Zealand and go, oh, well, fair enough. We are in New Zealand, aren't we? Things are just expensive here. And they go, oh, yeah, they are actually. So we'll be paying us the 6,000, please. And people here allow these companies to get away with it.
So it's three times as much,
yes,
more or less.
Well, yeah, it was 1,700 New Zealand dollars is what went on my credit card. 1,700 New Zealand dollars, 6,300 at
shop here.
I just bought a ukulele, and my partner bought the same one a while ago for 500 New Zealand, and I was like, look at that.
Yeah.
Got online, got it from Best Buy for 190 US. But then they wouldn't deliver it to New Zealand, so I did give it delivered to my cousin, and then she sent it to me. So it's ended up in my hands for about 260 New Zealand dollars.
Compared with what, sorry?
500.
Yeah. And this is not a large market being able to have the power of, you know, economy of size. This is individual purchases. So I'm paying retail prices in England. I'm paying for a single shipment. So I'm not getting the advantage of filling a container and chartering my own ship.
Did you think about buying about 12 and trying to sell them here?
Yeah, have you seen my garage? There's nowhere I could store them. But the problem is that even the most inefficient way of buying things, a single purchaser like me, could still get a fantastic deal compared to simply going to the shops.
You could have had an English holiday as well and still had change.
Absolutely. Have you seen the now marking up airfares in New Zealand? That's a whole other issue.
You could get cheaper breasts in Thailand as well, if you wanted.
But mine are fine already, thank you. Yeah. Don't need to be any bigger.
Okay, and we'll talk about the difficulties keeping your head above water shortly, actually, in another discussion. Steve McCabe on the panel. Penny Ashton.
Hello. Yes, hello. I've been thinking about genealogy, which I think people tend to do when they get a little bit older.
It's That's just true.
Years advance and things. But the reason is, and it was really astonishing, because I've been doing Jane Austen-style shows for about 5 years now. And then in January, my uncle on my mum's side, my mum's Australian, emailed and said, oh, you seem to be doing quite a bit about Jane Austen. I wonder if you know that your fifth great uncle was her boyfriend. And I was like, what? Because if people know Jane Austen never actually married, but the movie Becoming Jane, which is Anne Hathaway playing Jane Austen and James McAvoy playing my fifth great uncle, which is clearly the good handsome genes running the company in the family. But yeah, he is my great-grandmother's great-grandfather's brother. And I just found this connection to Jane Austen and, you know, and apparently, da-da-da, is the basis for Mr. Darcy. So I am related to Mr. Darcy.
But I thought the guy in the movie looked a bit like you.
Yes, exactly.
But I'm curious, you've been doing these Jane Austen shows for years.
Yep.
And your mum's only just...
Oh, my mum didn't know. It was my uncle.
Oh, so your uncle's only mentioned this year.
Well, I mean, I have family scattered about the world that you don't see that often, you know.
Right,
I see them whenever I'm in Sydney, but you don't go to Sydney very much, actually. And so he sort of gleaned it through Facebook, which I'm reasonably prolific on, that I was doing all this stuff. And it was just, I mean, it was astonishing to me that after doing it for so long and loving that movie, I watched that movie when I went to LA in 2007 on the plane and sobbed all the way because I'd just broken up with someone as well. And it's like, oh, I can't be with who I love either. Just like Jane Austen, because apparently they had to break up because he was in poverty. impoverished. And
was she on a plane to LA as well?
She was.
At the time.
Yeah, it was amazing.
It's what a coincidence.
Anyway, but now, and because he was Irish, he was actually also the Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. And then of course, when I'm thinking about that at the time, I'm like, oh, he probably sent a whole lot of people off to be convicts in Australia. And it's been really interesting to find that I was assumed that I had convicts, and I probably do have convicts somewhere in the line because it was so far back, but he was actually making convicts. And he was very orange in his colourings as well, obviously, you know, being in high up in the law in Ireland. And so then yesterday it was St. Patrick's Day, and I'm like, I don't really feel very Irish. I don't know when that sort of kicks in, but I was thinking about genealogy and all this sort of stuff anyway. And
you're only 2 degrees of separation from any thought.
Does that mean that I'm always vacant at any time?
No, that was inventive. No, I was following it with great interest.
But it was really interesting. I just was completely blown away by that.
That's fantastic.
It's almost better than being related to her because, you know, it was an unrequited love and Mr. Darcy and all that.
Fate flung you together with Jane Austen.
Well, I don't believe in fate either, much like prayer, but it's great.
This is amazing. Hearing this from you today, I was talking to another teacher at school today and we mentioned the film The Great Escape, and out of nowhere he said, well, I'll have you know that my great uncle was number 6 in line to get out of the tunnel.
Right.
I'm getting these all day today.
I know. So somebody that produces those telly shows should come, you know, who do you think you are with me? And take me back there.
Yeah, I'm just a walking coincidence machine.
That's what I see as fate, as coincidence.
What sort of cooker asks a texter costs, can you answer this briefly, 6,000?
Am I allowed to mention brand names?
I think so.
Probably not, because you've just...
It's a big 100-centimetre range cooker.
Right.
That we, like I said, we saw it in the shops here and went, oh, yes, please, but no thanks.
Okay, so it's a fancy cooker, but not super-duper top-of-the-range fancy.
No, it's not Arga, no. Definitely not Arga, no. It's a British brand.
Okay, all right. 10 to 5. Now, speaking of keeping one's head above water, younger generation lags behind its parents in wealth building, says the New York Times headline. A new study over there finds that Americans up to roughly the age of 40 have accrued less wealth than their parents did at the same age, even as the average wealth of Americans has doubled over the last quarter century. We suspect it's the same here. We're going to ask Philip McAllister, is there less wealth available to be built? Are a smaller number of people taking a larger percentage of the world's money prisoner? What do you think? What's your layperson's opinion?
Well, having lived in the US until fairly recently and having got out while I still could, I've seen the way things have changed there. And one of the big things that really has changed, and the same is true in this country, is the cost of housing as a fraction
of your
take-home income. Mm. And as long as housing is becoming increasingly expensive relative to your earnings, you're going to have less money for anything else, therefore you can't save. Now, oh, great, this comes a bit circular because part of the issue is you can't save for your house. But the same is true also of renting. The other thing you have to take into account is the fact that there is so much more that we need to spend money on these days. Our parents weren't paying for internet, cell phone, satellite telly. They didn't have to buy cups of coffee at Starbucks or wherever every single day and so on. Gym memberships, for example, and other things that we never use. There are all kinds of things that we pay for today that the previous generation hadn't even heard of.
Things were a bit more expensive back then, other things, however. But I mean, I see your point. But like, I've been doing some presenting on Heartland and prizes for game shows in the 70s, like a sheet set that cost $1,000.
I remember Celebrity Squares in England in the 1970s, and the prize was always £1,000.
14-inch television.
Steady on.
That's what it was. Top Dance 82.
Hey, was it colour?
Yes, colour.
Oh,
portable,
wow.
14-inch on Top Dance 82, and it was worth $1,019.
Okay. Just the young? You see, before we go to Philip, is it just the young? Because wonder if it's the middle-aged and elderly as well, because we hear it here regularly.
When does middle age start?
Not yet.
How old are you?
39. Yeah, no, clear.
No, it's well begun. Oh, yeah. Actually, I think officially 35, but that's ridiculous. No one's 30, middle-aged when they're 35.
No, but I'm certainly poorer than my parents. But my dad's a bit of a money-making machine. He's a salesman extraordinaire, and I'm like a poet, you know.
Do you ever wonder who the 200,000 people are who can afford to invest in Mighty River? Because judging by a lot of the emails we get in, older people are kind of just struggling and sometimes dipping into their savings.
How much do you need to invest in Mighty River? Is there a threshold?
Do we know yet?
It's 1,000 or 2,000.
It is.
Well, I don't know. They haven't decided how much people are going to get.
Right.
Financial services. I could be demonstrated wrong. Tell me if I am. Financial services blogger, founder of goodreturns.co.nz, Philip McAllister, joining us. Philip, hello.
Hello, Jim.
Is this the panic of the young, or in fact, are they right to be a bit afraid over whether they're going to be able to save money?
Oh, think everyone's always been afraid, you know, my parents, you know, about whether they're going to be able to save enough. I think one of the things which is really interesting is that it's really hard to save, there's no doubt about that, but I don't believe that people aim to get to retirement and be poor and live in destitution. There's lots of different ways of saving, and these aren't always captured by the statistics. I also think with you know, the younger generation, they have a longer life expectancy, so they've actually got a bit longer time to save than what our parents did. So, you know, there's a lot of different circumstances out there.
Okay. It's being suggested that there's been a pattern for a while of each generation doing better than the one before, but we're seeing a generation now who may reverse that trend. You're saying you can't pick that trend, Philip.
I think when you look at this article in the Wall Street Journal, it was talking very much obviously about the US, and there's been some pretty difficult circumstances over there in their housing market, for instance. You know, a lot of people lost their shirt there, and there were foreclosures all around the place. We certainly haven't seen that in New Zealand, and, you know, the property market in New Zealand has actually treated people pretty kindly. In fact, I'd argue that, you know, a lot of the people, you know, my parents' generation, their wealth was actually made through property, just as it is for many people today.
Can't you argue that that generation, you know, the affluent, the last affluent generation would be the ones that went to university for free?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, look, you know, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, our parents' generation had a pretty good ride. You know, they had free doctor's visits. They got, you know, family benefits. I remember Mum saving hers to buy new couches. You know, things like that. And you know, one of your panellists there said before, you know, we have to pay for a lot more things than we did in the past. And I think the hidden costs and the hidden taxes and things that we pay are actually quite crippling.
Do you think, you say correctly that people have done very well out of the housing market, but of course you have to be in it, don't you, to have done very, very well out of it, and a whole lot of people can't get in it.
And
well, that I actually have a really real issue with that, and I mean, a lot of it is difficult, and now don't get me wrong, it is difficult to get on there, but there's ways for people to get onto the property ladder, and I think people actually have to be realistic about it. The story I news is, you know, we publish a property magazine, and you know, over the years, we've had lots of young people, you know, come through the office here and work for us. They knew nothing about property, and when they left, they'd actually become educated about it, and they'd learned about property, they'd managed to buy their first homes, and some of them brought investment properties, and they were well on their way. And it comes back to this big issue about education, and that's actually what the fundamental issue here is, that, you know, financial literacy has to be made a compulsory subject in the school curriculum. If we educated our kids about, you know, money and how to save it and how to invest it, we'd actually not have a savings problem. I mean, the things like...
Do you reckon? Look, I'm not arguing with you about the need for financial literacy, but you can be as bright as you like and be broke at the moment, can't you, because your job simply doesn't pay enough.
No, but it comes down to the practical ways you manage money. I interviewed some kids a number of years ago who had done a financial literacy course through school. These were a couple of kids over in Hamilton, and I couldn't believe, you know, how much the basic knowledge they had picked up had set them in a good stead to get themselves through university in those first parts of their adult working life. Most of the kids go out there, all they do is they just blow their money and they have no idea about how to manage it. And that's what the government should be doing.
Yeah, but that's pretty simple financial literacy, isn't it? It's look after the pennies and the pounds, take care of themselves. I mean, that isn't, you know, financial rocket science, is it?
No, but if these kids aren't taught it,
but also you have to
get them responsibility for the parents here as well.
Get them to take the subject, because I certainly wouldn't have.
I did economics in the seventh form, and the only thing I remember about it is learning how to write a check. That's not much use now.
No, it's not.
Certainly not.
the young people you see, Steve McCabe, how much financial literacy do you suspect is there?
Oh, very, very little, to be perfectly honest.
So Philip's right.
Oh yeah, the kids I see, and the sense I get is, well, you know, that mummy and daddy either do have money and so it's always available, or they don't have money and so money's just a closed book to me. Either way, there's not a real connection between go out and work, accrue a bit of wealth, go out and spend it, and whatever's left over is a bonus. That connection isn't there.
But that hard reality, Philip, will presumably start to be felt more and more now that the good times for many people are over.
Oh, I think you could actually argue that things are picking up again. I mean, you know, we're seeing lots and lots more people, you know, interested in getting into property. And look, you know, whether you like it or you knock it, you know, property has actually helped a lot of people, you know, create wealth. One of the things which fascinates me about property investors, these are all people who've got off their butts. They said, we're not going to sit here and wait for the government to pay us a pension. We're going to make some money, we're going to provide for ourselves, and when we get to retirement, we're going to have a good retirement.
Rather unfortunately,
that's why they're doing it.
Rather unfortunately, you cannot apply that across the board, because if everybody invests in property, then that requires that basically all property is going to have to be rented. You're relying then on everybody renting from everybody else.
Well,
it becomes awfully circular.
But that brings you to another point, is I think if you compare the sorts of financial products that my parents had to invest in versus the sorts of things you have now, there's more opportunities to invest and there's more opportunities to create wealth than there were previously. You know, you think back to the old days and you had post office savings accounts paying you diddly squat and stuff. I mean, you have a lot more options out there now. So not everyone should do property. I think property only suits a certain type of personality.
Yeah.
Lots of people look at it, but they just don't have the courage to actually do it. And all right, that's the right decision for them. But there's lots of other options.
Thank you, Philip. Philip McAllister on the panel. Just closing down that discussion because we're almost out of time. The government's changed its mind on the new car park tax. Mm-hmm. That was the other piece of news this afternoon, as the benefits would have likely have been outweighed by the cost of compliance.
Indeed. Feel free
to give quick opinions if you like. Probably it's probably not an issue that impinges on your
not at all. I mean, no one's ever paid. I don't have sick pay or leave money. I don't need anything like that.
And so, you get a free park at school.
I take the train.
You take the train. I thought that, at schools was a problem and things like that. So it's good that it's not there anymore.
Penny Ashton, thank you.
Kia ora.
Steve McCabe, you too. Checkpoint follows, and we're back tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.